The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today we'll be reading from the July 30th and August 6th editions of the New Yorker magazine. First, we'll begin with a poem from the July 30th edition of the New Yorker. That will be followed by a special guest reading from the Talk of the Town section, and then a short story by Zadie Smith. So first the poem, entitled Seraphim, by Patricia Spears Jones. Once a beauty, full-figured, beloved, and then a fever, sweats, water vomited, until the body gave out, and then wings and lyres and legion of other angels, singing, dancing, flying about. But once a beauty remembers physical love, and then its loss, eternal life seems mundane, no conflict or need or desire. Thus, this seraphim held melancholy, gentle as a lull in a long conversation. But heaven allows only jubilance, possibly the angel needed to return. Human, with feelings, tears, and laughter, or find a way to shape this sadness into a moment of beauty when the angel's wings spread and flight moves to breathing, full of vision. There the angel's tears bond with the visitor's fear, awe. It could be a filmmaker's perambulating Berlin in search of a reason to consider the spirit those angels set on top of mountains across the handsome city. And they love the lovers, and one remains lovingly disinterested. How dreams and death and a dearth of joy is visible. And wings spread and wings fall, and the beloved becomes a man who understands a woman's full figure, a man who fears fever, a man who takes his lover in all her melancholy and lifts her up and unto joy. And next, from the Talk of the Town section, we have an essay written by Rosina Ali, the On the Street Department, an essay entitled Pilgrimage. And we have a special guest reader today, my father, Bill Mercer, 92 years old, 60 years in radio and television in Dallas, and a member of the Texas Radio Hall of Fame. Take it away, Bill.
Thank you, Evan. Back when Donald Trump was a presidential candidate, he said, "I think Islam hates us," and called for a local, total, and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. The realities of office reined him in somewhat, and in January of 2017, he signed an order to block the entry of people from only select Muslim-majority countries. The Supreme Court upheld the policy last month. What bothers Catherine Merriman, a Ph.D. candidate in Islamic Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, is that Trump misses the fact that Islam is already part of America's history. For the past 4 years, Merriman has been giving Muslim history tours of Trump's hometown, focusing on Harlem. There are roughly 300 mosques in New York City, she said. New York is one of the most, if not the most, diverse Muslim cities in the world. There is no such thing as Muslim world somewhere else. Mary was raised Irish Catholic in Westchester and often visited Washington Heights, where her father grew up. She became interested in Islam after 9/11, when she started taking philosophy and religion classes in college. The tour began in 2014 when a friend asked her to speak with a group of visiting college students, members of the Ismaili branch of Islam. Merriman had been researching the African-American Muslim diaspora, and she riffled through her notes. "A map appeared before me," she recalled. She took the students around Harlem and eventually created a Facebook event called Muslim History Tour in NYC. In 3 days, she received more than 300 RSVPs. Merriam's free tours happen about 5 times a year whenever she can fly up from North Carolina. On a recent windy Sunday morning, about 15 people assembled near the Adam Clayton Powell Jr. State Office Building on 125th Street. They came from Harlem, Crown Heights, and Philadelphia. Trevor Stevens, a high school physics teacher, chatted with Marco Ramirez, an academic, about another tour, a literary crawl through the West Village. "I heard there's one in Midtown, too," Ramirez said. "There were writers in Midtown?" Stevens asked. Merriman started off by telling the group about the first Muslims in New York, who arrived in the 1600s as slaves. More came as immigrants. One of the first registered mosques in New York was started in 1907 in Williamsburg by Muslim Lithuanians, Russians, and Poles. Before the hipsters came, it was Eastern Europeans. Turning to the office building behind her, Merriman explained that this was the former site of the African National Memorial Bookstore, where a young Malcolm X read about Africa and the Middle East. Pulling out a pair of portable speakers, she played an interview with the bookstore's founder, Louis Michaud, in which he declared, "This country can't stand truth." Merriman pointed out the elaborate lettering on the nearby Alhambra Ballroom, built in 1905, bore for leading the way to the Nation of Islam's Mohammed Mosque No. 7 on 127th Street. She bought a copy of the group's newspaper, The Final Call, from two men wearing bow ties. The Nation of Islam says that in the 1960s, 600,000 issues of its newspapers were sold every week, she shouted above the wind. These newspapers were a way for people to get international news. Music was a prominent part of the tour. Down the street from the Apollo Theater, Merriman identified a DSW store that had once been a Sunni mosque frequented by jazz musicians. She played the John Coltrane song, A Love Supreme, noting that its lyrics are often understood as Allah Supreme. Coltrane's first wife was Muslim. The Allah School in Mecca, near 126th Street, belongs to an offshoot of the Nation of Islam called the 5% Nation. Merriman explained how 5% symbols have been invoked by rappers like Busta Rhymes and Wu-Tang Chan. Ayad El Klar, who wore a brown skullcap and a prayer beads, listened intently. It was his second time in Merriman's tour. "This used to be the headquarters of a lot of hip-hop," he said. At 123rd Street and Frederick Douglass Boulevard, Merriman warned the group that the next stop is a police station. "Now, if people don't feel comfortable, I'll tell you where to meet us." Standing near a mural at the 28th Street precinct, she discussed the history of Muslims and law enforcement, including the FBI's surveillance and targeting of black Muslim activists for un-American activities. "Things that we think happen after 9/11 have been happening since the 1940s, she said. It was past 1 o'clock. The tour arrived at the Malcolm Shabazz Mosque, which was firebombed in 1965. "I'll end here with how I'm concerned about all this. Malcolm X was assassinated in Washington Heights at the Ottoman Ballroom. My dad was 16. He and his friends rode up on their bikes, and there were huge crowds. He saw all the guys with bow ties. No one could believe it when someone said Malcolm was shot. This summer, Merriman will start a Wall Street era tour, which will cover Little Syria and the site of the Ottoman Mosque on Rector Street. She told the group, "Your job is to keep those stories alive."
And now from the fiction section, a short story by Zadie Smith entitled Now More Than Ever. There is an urge to be good, to be seen to be good, to be seen, also to be. Badness, invisibility, things as they are in reality as opposed to the things as they seem, death itself. These are out of fashion. This is basically what I told Mary. I said, "Mary, all these things I just mentioned are not really done anymore. And also, while we're on the subject, that name of yours is not going to fly. Nobody's called Mary these days. It's painful for me even to say your name. Actually, could you get the hell out of here?" Mary left. Scout came by. A great improvement. Scout is so involved and active. She is on all platforms and rarely becomes aware of anything much later than, say, the 300th person. By way of comparison, the earliest I've ever been aware of anything was that time I was the 10,206th person to see that thing. There's evidently a considerable gulf between Scout and me. But that's why I am always so appreciative of her coming by and giving me news. Now, according to Scout, the news is that the past is now also the present. I invited her to pull up a stool at my mid-century modern breakfast bar and unpack that a little for me. The light that afternoon was beautiful. From my place on the 11th floor, I could see all the way to the Hudson, and it filled me with optimism and an eagerness to be schooled. But Scout was cautious, believing me incapable of either trans-historical thought or platform mastery. She placed a New York Sports Club tote bag on the counter and pulled out two puppets, homemade, insultingly basic. The first was a recognizably female human, although she had long arms, terribly long, at least three times the length of her body, and no nose. The other was a kind of a triangular spindle with a smudgy face painted on both sides, trailing thread from its corners, which I could have sworn I'd seen someplace before. Scout's demonstration was quite detailed. I don't want to get into it all here, but the essence of it was consistency. "You've got to reach far, far back," she explained, "into the past," hence the arms, "and you've got to make sure that when you reach back, thusly, you still understand everything back there in the exact manner in which you understand things presently. For if it should turn out that you don't, that is, if after some digging, someone finds evidence that past you, oh, excuse me, that is, after some digging, someone finds evidence that present you is fatally out of step with past you, well then, you'll simply have to find some way to remake the connection, and you've got to make it seamless. Not double-faced or double-sided, like this triangle spindle guy, but seamless. Because otherwise you are, and were, in all kinds of trouble." Seamless. Seamless. At which point, we both got hungry and paused to order a couple of poke bowls. "Here's a question for you, re-consistency," I said, putting my elbows on the counter. "I know this woman who's a big fancy CEO. Her name is Natalia Lefkowitz. She's totally squared the past with the present, is admired by all, and is not only seen to be good, but actually does good in the world for many people, providing clean water and equitable job creation and maternity leave and plenty of other inarguable benefits for women here, there, and everywhere. But yesterday she got this message." I showed Scout the message, which I had received on my phone from someone called Ben Trainer, apparently an ex-boyfriend of Natalia, whose son, I mean Natalia's son, was in my Kafka and Kierkegaard class a few years ago. According to this Ben trainer, Natalie had liked to do things in the very recent past that were not consistent with her existence in the present. Stuff like sodomizing Ben Trainer while pretending to be his mother. Also calling him Daddy while he pretended to be holding her as a sex slave in a crawl space underneath their own East Hampton kitchen. At the time, they had both agreed to these oppositional kinks, but when they broke up, it occurred to Ben that although there was no contradiction between his own life and his intimate life, Ben worked as the general manager of a leather bar down on Rivington. There was surely a big old gap between how Natalia morally lorded it around in her professional existence and the weird feces she was into behind closed doors. In Ben's opinion, these dark desires went way beyond kink into problematic. Which was the reason he was texting everybody in Natalia's address book to let them know. Scout, I asked, do you think she should be afraid? Do I think she should be afraid? That's your question. That's my question. Scout packed up her puppets and left, accusing me of flippancy and misjudging the current climate. We never even got to the pokey. Sometimes I think I don't ask the right questions. In my apartment building, as in many throughout the city, we have this new routine. We stand at our windows, all of us, from the second floor to the 17th, and hold aloft large signs with black arrows on them. The arrows point to other apartments. In our case, to the apartments of our colleagues at the university. The only abstainers are the few remaining Marxists, mainly in the history department, though we have a few in English and sociology, too, who like to argue that the whole process is fundamentally Stalinist. Which is like calling a child Mary. Who even uses that kind of language these days? Bendelstein, Eastman, and Waite are pointing at me. A purely defensive move. I have done nothing wrong and am no one, and they are only trying to distract attention from themselves. I am pointing at Eastman in his dank little studio with the paisley carpet. Yes, since my illuminating discussion with Scout, I have decided to join the majority of my colleagues in the philosophy department and point at Eastman, because who doesn't know about Eastman? How Eastman still has a job, we really don't know. Not only does he not believe the past is the present, but he has gone further and argued that the present, in the future, will be just as crazy looking to us in the present as the past is presently to us right now. For Eastman, surely, it's only a matter of time. Well, I made a date with young Scout to go to the forum. I felt we'd taken a wrong turn, and I wanted to get our friendship back on track. I don't like this friction between the generations. We went to see A Place in the Sun, starring Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor, and Shelley Winters. I don't do that just to be cute. I genuinely feel bad for Shelley Winters. And if you've ever seen that movie with its carnival of physical beauty, into which poor, plain Shelley Winters has been placed as counterbalance, you'll know that 8-point type is a fair and accurate representation of the situation. The anti-hero of this picture, by strange coincidence, is called Eastman, George Eastman. He's played by Clift, who always makes me want to type the word febrile. It's as if he's so beautiful, it's making him ill. When I mentioned this to Scout, she asked me why I thought physically objectifying men was any different from objectifying women. I had no answer, and I returned to my popcorn. George Eastman is the poor East Coast relation of a rich California family that runs a big, successful bikini business. Young Eastman grew up in his super religious mother's Christian mission, proselytizing on the streets, probably shaking a can for coins. But now he's come out west to ask his old Uncle Eastman for a job. To cut a long story short, he falls in love with two girls. One is sweet, ordinary, sincere, lower class, Shelley Winters. Shelley works with him on the factory floor, stuffing bikinis into boxes, and happens not to be able to swim. This will become important later. The other is hot as hell, Elizabeth Taylor, rich, upper class, an Eastman family friend. Seeing as he has no chance with Taylor, George gets things going with Shelley, although relationships are banned in the factory, and if they're discovered, they'll both lose their jobs. Unfortunately, Shelley falls pregnant. All of this is sometimes hard to follow because the movie was made in 1951 and everything's buried under the Hays Code. No one says pregnant or I want an abortion, but despite the polite cutaways and the euphemistic language, you get the picture. Two unmarried people with no money who hardly know each other are about to have a baby that neither of them wants. What to do? Shelley thinks the only solution is to get married. George doesn't want to. In the middle of this crisis, George bumps into Taylor again. This time she notices that he looks like Montgomery Clift and falls madly in love with him. So now, Shelley is a problem. Gotta get rid of Shelley. But how? To distract himself from the urgency of this question, George accepts an invitation to Taylor's parents' beach house and spends a weekend looking tanned and expensive, beautiful and happy, and not at all like a poor boy from Chicago who once walked the streets pleading with the lost and sinful to join him in the bosom of Christ. Throughout this section of the movie, Scout kept leaning over to ask me, "Did Montgomery Clift make this before or after his car accident? IRL? I really couldn't say. Whenever I thought it was after, I found myself noticing strange marks in his face, a cut on his cheek, or the scar from a huge laceration on his neck. But then when I thought it was before, his face looked perfect to me, as if God had taken Brando and Dean and found a way to combine them in a delicious man sandwich." At a certain point, while George is trying to forget his troubles at the beach, Shelley Winters calls from the bus station and says that if he doesn't marry her right away, she's going to come over to that beach house, publicly expose him, and mess up his whole life. He makes his excuses to Taylor and her family and goes to meet Shelley. They head to the registry office and to get married, but it's closed. To calm her, George suggests a picnic out in the woods by the lake, and maybe that's when he remembers the time she told him that she couldn't swim. He hires a rowboat under a false name and takes her out on the water, apparently with the full intention of killing her. And she does die that very day in murky circumstances. The two of them argue in the little rowboat. It tips, they fall in, and the next thing we see is George dragging himself up the bank. Did he try to save her? Did he swim away? Did he force her head down, down, down into the water? Was it murder in the first degree, or in some other degree? Was it even murder? We can't know. We'll never know. George heads back to his weekend paradise. Taylor's parents, black maid, happens to be making lunch. And you see her only three or four times, and she barely speaks. But let's just say that she had my full attention. I admired the way she acted as if she were fully invested in this drama unfolding at Taylor's parents' beach house, even though, in my mental version, this fictional maid's fictional brother was one of the several thousand people who were lynched, IRL. In the first half of the 20th century. Each time she appeared, I gave her a little improvised dialogue, whispering it into Scout's ear. "Yes, miss, I'll bring the dessert out now. I mean, my brother was lynched not long ago down in Arkansas, but I can see you've got bigger fish to fry. I'll get it right on it." I let out a sort of ugly laugh as I said it, but I knew that nothing I could do in the present could ameliorate or change this fictional fact. No, all I could do was remember it and tell myself I was remembering it, so that it wasn't forgotten, although with the mental proviso that suffering has no purpose in reality. To the suffering person, suffering is solely suffering. It is only for others as a symbol that suffering takes on any meaning or purpose. No one ever got lynched and thought, well, at least this will lead inexorably to the civil rights movement. They just shook and suffered and screamed and died. Pain is the least symbolic thing there is. There's a key scene after my stoic maid has tidied lunch away when Taylor and George and a load of other happy, young, rich people jump into a flashy speedboat that is leaving from the dock. Off they fly, whooping up and smiling with their perfect American teeth. Meanwhile, we, the anxious folk at the forum, stay on the dock in the foreground where a lone radio sits, and we listen to this radio as the happy young people frolic in the distance. We hear that Shelley Winters has died in a lake, that the police think it's murder, and they're closing in on the perpetrator. Which means that everyone on that boat, including Elizabeth Taylor, will soon know that George Eastman, also known as Montgomery Clift, is guilty as sin, or is guilty to some, perhaps ultimately unknowable degree. I found myself clutching Scout's hand quietly, weeping. Later, on the way out of the cinema, Scout asked me if I instinctively sympathized with this rich and happy woman. I said, I didn't understand the question. She said, put it another way. You instinctively sympathize with perpetrators instead of victims. Since that was less a question than a statement, all I could do was add a statement to her statement. I said, in our philosophy department at the university, we feel that just as there are degrees of sin or error, there are degrees of sympathy. It's not a zero-sum game, or it used to not be in the past. Well, there's your problem, Scout said. You're two-faced, you're looking the wrong way, and if you don't watch out, you're going to find yourself beyond the pale. She went off to catch the one train, and while I trudged back to my tower alone, making note of the fact that I'd be seeing no more films at the Forum for a spell because it was closing for the summer so that a fourth screen could be built. That's what I need, I thought as I walked. A fourth screen. If I had a fourth screen, no reality could get through the cracks at all. I would be able to live only in symbol, and then surely everything would be easier. I was at LaGuardia Place before I noticed that almost everyone on the sixth floor was angling their arrows upward, directly at my apartment, though I wasn't even there. Montgomery Clift isn't rich or happy. He's guilty. I instinctively sympathize with the guilty. That's my guilty secret. In the current climate, a high school student wrote to me, Dear Professor, I am a high school English student in South Bend, Indiana. I am quite intrigued by your use of metaphor in your recent piece in Philosophy Today. But why do you choose to make the metaphor so obvious? And why would you not really take a stand for or against by specifically saying his name? And why would you choose to omit his name if you are taking a stand? Thanks, a high school student. I wrote back, Dear high school student, have you seen that video? It's a little like that. Some things are so obvious that subtle metaphor is impossible. In that video, for example, there was no point in being subtle about the state-funded violence inflicted on black people in this country. The only way was to show it explicitly. And when we saw all those people dancing in the foreground, that was again the most obvious metaphor possible, i.e., while you're watching these black people dance and entertain you, other black people are dying. As to your other question, I guess it seems to me that some things are so low or evil or contemptible that they barely deserve a name. Giving them a name would be to honor them more than they deserve. See also, quote, he who shall not be named, end quote. Yours, Professor. This did not particularly satisfy the high school student, and I can see why. Apart from anything else, I was the 10,206,000 person to watch that video, so my opinions on it were easily discounted. And even the Lord himself called the devil a variety of euphemistic names. Besides, teenagers can sniff out the truth. The truth is, I didn't want to be deported. The next week, making no reference whatsoever to our previous exchange, the high school student struck again. "Hey, Professor, it's me, back to bother you. My English teacher's having us write a prompt comparing certain eras of literature and what their authors would say in response to Hamlet's Quintessence of Dust monologue. 99.9% of the authors are dead, but you are very much alive. I have pasted the monologue below just in case you are not familiar with it. Thank you so much for your time." I have, of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, foregone all custom of exercises, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition, that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof, fretted with golden fire, why, it appeareth no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors. What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty! In form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Thanks, a high schooler. I replied, "Dear high schooler, I'd say he's having a quarter-life crisis. Best, Professor. Oh, P.S. I know it's not much, but on the other hand, as you say, almost everybody else is dead, and I am very much alive." I bumped into someone on Bleecker who was beyond the pale. I felt like talking to him, so I did. As we talked, I kept thinking, "But you're beyond the pale." Yet instead of that stopping us from talking, we started to talk more and more frantically, babbling like a couple of maniacs about a whole load of things: shame, ruin, public humiliation, the destruction of reputation, that immortal part of oneself, the contempt of one's wife, one's children, one's colleagues, personal pathology, suicidal ideation, and all that jazz. I thought, maybe if I am one day totally and finally placed beyond the pale, I, too, might feel curiously free of expectation, of the opinions of others, of a lot of things. "It's like prison," he said, not uncheerfully. "You don't see anybody, and you get a lot of writing done." If you're wondering where he would be placed on a badness scale of 1 to 10, as I understand it, he is, by general admission, hovering between a 2 and a 3. He did not have victims so much as annoyed parties. What if he had had victims? Would I have talked to him then? But surely in that case, in an ideal world, after a trial in court, he would have been sent to a prison, or, if you more enlightened ideas about both crime and punishment, to a therapeutic facility that helps people not to make victims of their fellow humans. Would I have visited him in prison? Probably not. I can't drive, and besides, I have never volunteered for one of those programs in which sentimental people, under the influence of the Gospels, consider all humans to be essentially victims of one another and of themselves, and so go to visit even the worst offenders, bringing them copies of the Gospels and also sweaters that they've knitted. But that wasn't the case here. He was beyond the pale, and I wasn't. We said our goodbyes, and I returned to my tower, keeping away from the window for the afternoon, not being in the mood for either signs or arrows. I didn't know where I was on the scale back then, last week. I was soon to find out. Boy, was I soon to find out. But right now, in the present that I'm telling you about, I saw through a glass darkly, like you probably, like a lot of people. Then I made a mistake. This was yesterday. If you're anything like Scout, you probably heard about it already. Scout emailed me 15 minutes after it happened to commiserate and also to alert me to the fact that she would not be emailing me anymore. How it happened was, one of our poets said something beyond the pale. He's one of the newer poets, the musical kind, and so his words tend to go everywhere, floating between our towers, rising above the city. People were appalled, furious, all arrows pointed to him. And I said, look, politically, you're absolutely within your rights to be angry, but existentially, you're wrong. Existentially, this particular poet just wants us all to be free. As a matter of fact, he's not even a poet at all. He's a philosopher. Yes, I said it. He's one of us. But then the poet himself said that philosophy makes nothing happen, and also that he happened to quite like the devil, whom we sometimes call the adversary, and sometimes nothing at all. And then he said that he was glad that he who shall not be named had come to power, because he admired his energy, his inability to distinguish between past, present, and future. And soon after that, the poet got canceled, and soon after that, me too. And now, my dad, Bill Mercer, is going to return and read to us an essay from the Talk of the Town section, the comment department, entitled Get Out and Vote by George Packer. Bill, take it away.
In this haze of summer, with books still to be read, weeds pulled, kids retrieved from camp, it's a little hard to fathom that 3 months from now, American democracy will be on the line. This midterm election in November, the last remaining obstacle to President Trump's consolidation of power. None of the other forces that might have checked the rise of a corrupt, homegrown oligarchy can stop or even slow it. The institutional clout that ended the presidency of Richard Nixon no longer exists. The honest price and the honest press, for all its success, is exposing daily scandals, won't persuade the unpersuadable or shame the shameless, while the dishonest press is Trump's personal amplifier. The federal courts, including the Supreme Court, are rapidly becoming instruments of partisan advocacy, as reliably conservative as elected legislatures. It's impossible to imagine the Roberts Court voting unanimously against the president as the Burger Court, including five Republican appointees, did in forcing Richard Nixon to turn over his tapes. Brett Kavanaugh, Trump's nominee to succeed Anthony Kennedy, has even suggested that the decision was wrong. Congress has really submitted to the president's will, as if legislation and oversight were burdens to be relinquished. And when the independent counsel finally releases his report, it will have only the potency that the guardians of the law and the Constitution give it. Now, behind these institutions lies public opinion, and we are quickly learning that it matters more than laws, more than the Constitution, more than the country's supposedly inviolable founding principles. If large numbers of people are interested in freedom of speech, there will be freedom of speech, even if the law forbids it, George Orwell wrote in The Freedom of the Park. If public opinion is sluggish, inconvenient minorities will be persecuted, even if laws exist to protect them. During 1973, the year Watergate became a national scandal, facts changed the political views of millions of Americans. Nixon's approval rating fell from 67% to less than 30%, and his fate was sealed. In our time, large blocks of public opinion are barely movable. Trump's performance in Helsinki, declaring himself on the side of Russia against his own intelligence agencies and the integrity of American elections, received favorable reviews from 80% of Republicans. Yet, public opinion still plays a central role in safeguarding democracy. And it becomes decisive through voting. Demonstrations can capture attention and build solidarity. Books can provide arguments. Social media can organize resistance. But if the Republicans don't suffer a serious defeat in November, Trump will go into 2020 with every structural advantage. Democrats have a habit of forgetting to vote between presidential elections. Republican turnout has exceeded or equaled Democratic turnout in every midterm since 1978, no matter which party held the presidency, with an average margin of 3%, more than enough to decide control of Congress in a closely divided election. The demographic group that are least likely to vote, young people, Latinos, and those with high school education or less, tend to be Democratic constituencies. This evidence has been equally stark in the past two midterms. In 2014, the turnout among eligible voters aged 18 to 29 was 17%, 1 in 6. The disappearing Democratic voter also had an effect on the latest presidential election, when, for example, African-American turnout dropped almost 5% from 2012, a crucial difference in the three key states that gave Trump the Electoral College. Republicans, for their part, don't always entrust their hold on power to Democratic methods. Since 2010, nearly half of the states have passed laws that make it harder to vote, from restrictions on early voting to ID requirements, mandatory proof of citizenship, and purges of voting rolls. The purpose of these laws is not to fight a mythical epidemic of fraud, but to depress turnout of normally Democratic constituencies. They show incremental signs of success. A government study found that new laws reduced turnout in 2012 in Kansas and Tennessee by 2 or 3%, notably among young and black voters. Other states have expanded the franchise, particularly no former felons. But Republican control of two-thirds of state legislatures and the shift of courts to the right give the momentum to efforts to curtail voting. Gerrymandering is another effective tool for staying in power. The Brennan Center for Justice recently released a report on the effects of redistricting in states like Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, and Texas. Algorithmic mapping has grown so precise that Republican legislatures have created a 16-seat advantage in the House of Representatives that remains impervious to standard electoral pressures. In November, just to achieve a bare majority, Democrats will have to win the national congressional vote by nearly 11%. Other studies put the number at around 7%. And legislators elected this year will draw state and federal districts after the 2010-2020 census. There's a thick seawall standing in the way of a blue wave. But it's self-defeating to exaggerate the external obstacles in 2018. Democratic turnout declined in states with and without new votes. Gerrymandering is a time-honored practice of both parties. Look at Maryland's House delegation. Unfettered money in politics doesn't always favor Republicans, let alone guarantee victory. Hillary Clinton raised twice as much as Trump did. The greatest obstacle to the voting is the feeling that it won't matter, and that feeling seems to be more prevalent among Democrats. In some cases, that sense may be based on overconfidence and insularity, a presumption that the other party's outrages will automatically disqualify it in voters' eyes. More often, it comes from belief that politics doesn't change anything in people's lives. For two generations, the Republican Party has been an expression of grassroots conservatism, most recently the fever that's seeded the party to Trump. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party has grown less contented and connected to its voters. It's like a neglected building, perennially on the edge of collapse, which left-leaning Americans occasionally use for some purpose and then abandon. This year, something seems to be changing. The new faces among Democratic candidates, the new energy behind them, suggest a party of members, not squatters. But come November, they will have to vote. It's the only thing left.
And now, from the critics section on television, an essay entitled Blunt Tools, Pranks and Masculinity on Who is America? And Nathan for You. Before screening Sacha Baron Cohen's Who is America?, Showtime Flax handed me a non-disclosure agreement. They locked up my phone. Guards roamed the aisles with night vision goggles. The implication was clear. This show, heralded by panicky press releases from politicians, was incendiary stuff. Then, 3 days later, the network tiptoed backward like Trump after Helsinki. At its core, Who is America is a comedy show, a pre-airing email insisted. This is not a statement on the state of the country, but Baron Cohen experimenting in the playground of 2018 America. Please. Better for Showtime to own what it's doling out, an ugly response to an ugly age. Baron Cohen is a skilled troll whose work is fueled by contempt. Though he'd probably prefer to be described as a buffoon, the rule-breaking clown who exposes hypocrisy. Baron Cohen studied with the French clown Philippe Gallier, an expert on the tradition. When his sketches get laughs, they're barks of disgust, as when I found myself yelling, "Are you effing kidding me?" during the now famous montage of prominent NRA shills, including the former Congressman Trent Lott and Joe Walsh, plugging a program to train toddlers to shoot guns. The show uses nihilism as a stripping agent, sort of the way the Cat in the Hat touted Voom as the proper method to clean up the stain he'd helped create. During its weaker segments, it's juvenile, and in maddening, unexamined ways, misogynist. But during the Ken Guardian segment, which manages to nail the GOP, the NRA, and right-wing support for Israel, Baron Cohen's method is like radiation. Sickening, but better than cancer, unless it kills you first. He's the Tocqueville by way of Willy Wonka, a sadist who's certain he can separate bad eggs from good ones. The basic technique is identical to that of Baron Cohen's earlier prank TV series, Da Ali G Show, and the movie Borat, in which he plays bigoted idiots who cajole targets into doing dumb things. Work that has aged poorly. These days you could get people to sing Throw the Jew Down the Well without having to fake a Kazakh accent. Because Baron Cohen is famous, he now disguises himself using prosthetics that could pass for real only in a culture in which we accept that some men resemble steroidal, nipped, and tucked Frankensteins. The new characters are all straight white men, for all his heralded edginess. Baron Cohen clearly knows that cross-identity disguises won't fly, And as a result, his show is, by default, but without much self-awareness, about white masculinity. Baron Cohen plays Rick Sherman, an ex-con, the liberal cuck Dr. Neera Kane in Giocello, Billy Wayne Ruddock Jr., a MAGA type who runs a website called Truth Library, Colonel Aaron Morad, an Israeli strongman who with his monster virility is the best realized, and Gio Manaldo, an Italian philanthropist. The more striking fact is that of all the writers, all of his writers are also white men, including Nathan Fiedler of Nathan For You and the Inside Amy Schumer writer Kurt Metzger. That's a choice, one that warps the show's vision, both of what's funny, and who America is. There are two kinds of bad sketches here. The first are anodyne demonstrations of the fact that most people are polite when talking to crazy people, because who needs trouble? Some feature big shots like Ted Koppel, others ordinary human beings, like a Republican couple who never take the bait. These sketches rise and fall on the gags, which are hit and miss. Cohen tells the couple that he encourages his adolescent daughter Malala to free bleed. Ba-da-bump. The second kind takes cheap shots, often at women. In one sketch, a gallery consultant encourages the ex-con's artistic aspirations, and somehow, because she's cool with him using stuff and ejaculate as his medium, gross but not that outrageous in the art world, we are meant to sneer rather than see her as the sketch's hidden hero. In another, the reality star Corinne Olympios tells insane lies about charitable work. The power dynamics are all wrong here, too. Baron Cohen is in disguise as an expert on philanthropy, a subject that Olympios knows nothing about. Why wouldn't a reality star believe that false narratives were the norm? The political sketches are more pungent. In the second episode, Baron Cohen goads the Georgia Republican Congressman Jason Spencer into a series of acts so unhinged. Among other things, Spencer chases a terrorist backward while quite literally showing his ass, that he was forced to resign. Now, that's impressive, although the message is somewhat unclear. In 2018, you can use the N-word if your pants stay up. The episode's best sketch is more controlled. In it, Baron Cohen visits a depressed town in Arizona. As Kane Indochello, he offers to revitalize the downtown area. The crowd cheers, and then he reveals that the investment will go toward building the largest mosque outside the Middle East, and the townspeople turn on him. That would probably look good in a fire, one man mutters. Don't worry. Baron Cohen reassures him, as if the man were concerned about the safety of the Muslim spring. It would be made of stone. The prank is sadistic, but like Michelle Wolf's routine at the White House Correspondents Association dinner, its aim is true. There are no jizz jokes, no fat gags. Baron Cohen simply builds a Vegas act from studies showing that, for white voters, bigotry trumps economic anxiety. It's a smart sketch that will convince no one and change nothing. That's the problem with contempt. If Baron Cohen's act, even in its cleverest bits, feels sour, that's because it's just one shard in a kaleidoscope of heart-hardening stunts. His show feels existentially linked to every kid on 4chan, hunting lulls, TMZ, shoving cameras into faces to create an outburst, to reality show producers goading drunk girls to fight, to revenge porn and compromat and James O'Keefe's deceptively edited right-wing hoax videos, every troll has a moral rationale after all. Even feces posters harassing grieving families believe that they're exposing sentimentality. When chaos rises, sex techniques converge. Just open the Overton window and shove. Baron Cohen's Trumpish relish for humiliation places him at the nastier end of a tradition that runs from candid camera through punked. At their best, these are game shows about human nature, revealing moments of spontaneity and even beauty. The question of whether they punch up or down depends on whom you see as powerful. Does every star deserve to get punked? Well, maybe so. It's not odd that these shows were hosted by white guys. Most TV comedy was, until recently. But it is worth noting that two recent series about a black or female comedian meeting strangers, W. Kamau Bell's United Shades of America and Sarah Silverman's I Love You, America, were pay-ons to empathy. The opposite is risky. Try to imagine an undercover Latino comic pulling a prank on an ICE agent, or an all-female hashtag MeToo show exposing misogynists. I'm imagining it right now. So far, outsider comics aren't out punking the NRA unless you count Maria Butina. Nathan For You, which ended its fourth season on Comedy Central in November, bears a more distinct relationship to Who is America? The show similarly employs hilariously elaborate Rube Goldbergian setups. It too favors cringe comedy, but the result is more humane, driven by curiosity. The premise is that Nathan Fielder, a white male Canadian comic, is a gonzo business consultant. He rebrands a realtor as a ghost realtor. He reclassifies smoke detectors as musical instruments, but his stunts inevitably take absurdist detours. In one episode, Nathan's attempt to increase sales at an antique shop by encouraging drunks to pay for broken ceramics involves a sumo wrestling costume and a sexual confession lurid enough that the proceedings nearly grind to a halt. It's a parody of corporate think, which lets chaos and need bleed through every interaction. Well, sounds like we've run out of time for today's broadcast once again. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed reading it today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's all for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer and
Bill Mercer.
So long, everybody.
So long, everybody.